Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did African Americans and slavery play into the War of 1812? The second war for U.S. independence was sparked by conflicts over trade, citizenship rights, and U.S. designs on Native American territories Great Britain did not want it to possess. But for thousands of enslaved blacks, the war also represented a rare opportunity to escape lives of forced labor and the hope that service on the battlefield would be rewarded with freedom. Gene Allen Smith is here to tell us about it. He is professor of history at TCU and director of the Center for History Studies there. He is also a curator of history at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, and he's author of the new book, The Slave's Gamble, Choosing Sides in the War of 1812. Gene, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris.
So talk a little bit about how American slavery was different in the years preceding the War of 1812 than it would become later in the 19th century.
Well, I think in the years leading up to the War of 1812, in the post-revolutionary period, post-period of the American Revolution, there was the expectation and belief because of the Declaration of Independence and this revolutionary fervor that had come from that, that there would be a broadening of the franchise and a broadening of freedom. I mean, when Thomas Jefferson wrote that all men are created equal. Now, granted, he wasn't talking about blacks, but there was the hope and expectation that slavery would eventually be eradicated. Now, as we move into the early part of the 19th century, there are many northern states that have already started to dismiss slavery, and some southern states had started to loosen its stranglehold on slavery. But by the time the War of 1812 comes, it closes that door once and for all, and we will not see that slaves have an opportunity for freedom until the American Civil War.
So before the War of 1812, what sorts of lives could freed slaves choose for themselves, and where did they choose to go when they were allowed to move wherever they wanted?
Well, I think you can look at places like Baltimore and Philadelphia and New Orleans and see in those particular cities there were wonderful opportunities for people to live normal lives. I mean, they could be carpenters or they could be cooks or blacksmiths, whatever occupation that they wanted to follow, as long as they could find an opportunity to practice their trade, then they could make a life for themselves. Once you move out of these urban centers, it became harder and harder because there were fewer economic possibilities. Now, across the South, slavery was becoming more and more entrenched. And for the individual slaves themselves, there were just so few opportunities to break free of that bondage.
Was the treatment any more or less cruel and restrictive than it would become later in the 19th century?
Well, I think before the war, it is less cruel and less restrictive. I think in the post-war period, you'll see southern states, they learned a lesson in the War of 1812. What they learned is that slaves could not be counted on to help Americans. And in that post-war period, across the opening up of new slave lands across the Gulf South, places like present-day Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana, once you have these lands opening up and the understanding that it was going to be slavery plantation agriculture and the production of cotton, then slaves became an essential workforce to make that crop successful. So once that happens, slavery becomes reinvigorated in the post-war period.
And when you say those lands were opened up, it's because the U.S. forces were able to remove Native Americans from
certainly
that land.
And in the South, you know, Andrew Jackson fought a war against the Creeks. And in the North, it is William Henry Harrison who is driving out the British and fighting against Tecumseh and the Shawnees. Both of those areas, North and South, are opened up. Of course, in the North, it's going to be predominantly grain lands, corn and other grains, wheat. In the South, once the Indians are driven out, those fertile cotton lands, or what would become cotton lands, provided incredible opportunities for those who saw an opportunity for the future.
So, Gene, I'm sure this makes you sort of cry in your bed at night, but people know the Revolutionary War, and they know the Civil War, and they know the War of 1812 started in 1812.
If we're lucky, they know that.
Talk about, you know, it's often called the Second War for American Independence. For those who haven't brushed up on American history in a while, spend a few minutes explaining for us that the reasons that we continued to have conflicts with Great Britain in the years preceding the war.
Well, I think part of the reason we have that conflict is in the post-American Revolutionary period. The peace treaty that ended the war had left certain issues unresolved. Among those issues were lands in the old Northwest, present-day Detroit, Michigan, for example. The British don't evacuate that officially until 1796. Now, even though they were supposed to evacuate it in 1783. Well, those tensions, and plus there were debts that were owed by American merchants to British mercantile houses. Those debts were not immediately paid, and there was the question about those. And then there were thousands of slaves that were liberated by the British and evacuated and taken to loyalist slaves taken to Canada. And there was the question about how were those going to be compensated. So there were all these tensions that were pent up and remaining from the post-war, from the American Revolutionary period. Now, by the early part of the 19th century, those tensions were starting to play out in a series of episodes. And one of the episodes that I describe in this book is in the introduction. It's called the Chesapeake Leopard Affair. And it's an episode in June of 1807 where a U.S. warship, the USS Chesapeake, it's sailing out of Norfolk Harbor on a shakedown cruise. So it's the first time it's going out to sea. And while it's still within sights of the Virginia Cape, a British warship, the HMS Leopard, hails the vessel, which basically is asking the American ship to stop. The British want to come aboard and search the vessel for British deserters, and the American captain flat out refused. I mean, this was a national warship. This was a question of sovereignty. And when he refused, well, the British, in short order, fired an entire broadside of guns into the American vessel. Ultimately, four men would die from this attack, and there would be some 18 men wounded and 22 holes in the hull of the ship. And the American ship, the captain surrenders it. He offers his sword to the British, and the British officers refuse it. But they come aboard, and they muster the crew, and they seize four men that they claimed were British deserters. Now, the reason I began with this story is because of those four men, three of them were black. And the British are claiming that they were British subjects. Now, that raised a lot of questions in my mind, because once the episode is over, Americans were clamoring for war. They desperately wanted to go to war right then and there against Great Britain. But no one made any reference to the fact that these men were black. And ultimately, the Thomas Jefferson administration would decide that war was not in the best interest at that time. We do pass an embargo, which meant we didn't trade with any foreign countries. The idea that if we're not trading at sea, the British won't seize our ships. And we waited. And over the next 4 years, there is a series of economic legislations that the American government would push through, all trying to force the British to acknowledge American rights.
And one of the things that we were arguing with them about was the right to say, if a British person had emigrated to the United States, to declare that person a U.S. citizen.
Certainly. Yes, the British did not recognize citizenship transfer. They believed that once you were born in the British Empire, you were, in effect, a British subject. Now, Americans were pretty liberal about citizenship because there were, you know, initially there were so few people born in America. Most people were coming to America because of the opportunities. And it was not uncommon for people to be able to spend 5 or 7 years and become a naturalized citizen. Now, for these sailors, especially these black sailors, they would be sure to try to get what were called naturalization papers. And they could go to any port where there was an American consul. They could pay a small fee, and they'd have a witness who said, okay, they were born in America or they had spent, you know, 20 years in America. And these official papers were, in effect, their papers of citizenship. Now, they tried to keep these on them all the time. But, you know, you're working on a ship, and it's wet, and it's messy. And, you know, most of the time they would put them in their duffel bag and keep them, try to keep them hid or stored so that whenever they're being mustered on ship and all of a sudden they're being dragged off, you know, they don't have their papers there to show I'm an American citizen. And even if they did, the British didn't recognize it. They said that once you were a British citizen, you were always a British citizen.
By what criteria would the British who were boarding these ships and impressing soldiers, by what criteria would they determine that someone was British or American? Did they listen to them speak?
Certainly. They would simply walk down the ranks and they would talk to people. And, you know, if they spoke with a Cockney accent, which most of them did, mm-hmm. you know, they could justifiably say, well, this person is a British subject. And then they would often bring ordinary sailors across with them and say, oh, yeah, that gentleman there, that sailor, he deserted from, you know, His Majesty's ship, so he needs to be brought back. So it was a pretty haphazard way of identifying sailors.
I want to go back for just a minute to Canada, because we think of this as the sort of lucky last stop on the Underground Railroad
yes.
in the antebellum era. But in fact, there was a time that enslaved people were trying to get south of Canada.
Exactly.
Talk about that.
That's one of the truly revealing features that I brought out in this book. And I knew nothing about it myself. And it all began with the slave Peter Dennison that I was working on. Peter was a slave in Detroit, and, you know, he ultimately is going to organize a platoon of black militiamen, and most of these militiamen were escaped slaves from Canada. And I was thinking, well, why were there slaves in Canada, first of all, and then why were they escaping to Detroit if, in fact, Peter Dennison was a slave? Mm-hmm. Well, there was in the late 18th century, there was a short period of time that slaves in Canada, they were doing a graduated emancipation. So a slave might have to wait 20 or 25 years before they would eventually be freed. And many of them would willingly take the chance to flee across the border to the Northwest Territory. Now, according to the Northwest Ordinance and the Land Ordinance of 85 and 87, you basically said that those lands would be free. Now, why was Peter Dennison, though, a slave? Well, the territorial governor there in Michigan, a guy named Augustus Woodward, he more or less declared that any slave that was a slave before the British turned the territory over officially in 1796, they remained a slave. So for a narrow window period, literally from 1796 to about 1815, you had slaves escaping from Canada going south into the Michigan Territory. Now, once the war is over, and I use Peter Dennison as an example of that, Peter Dennison, he'll be captured at the Battle of Detroit, where General William Hull surrenders his army, and the men are paroled. The officers are taken and held as captives. Apparently, Peter Dennison is paroled, and by 1816, we find him in a little community called Sandwich, which is just across the Detroit River in Canada. He, his wife, and his four children are there, and he's proclaimed himself a free man, even though he had been a slave earlier. And I think that is by 1815, 1816 is when you start to see the origins of what we acknowledge today as that Underground Railroad leading north to the freedom of Canada.
Gene Allen Smith is with us. He's professor of history at TCU and a curator of history at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, where he will be speaking this coming Tuesday at 7. He's also author of the brand new book, The Slave's Gamble, Choosing Sides in the War of 1812. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, talking about TCU this hour with TCU history professor Gene Allen Smith. He's also curator of history at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, and he's director of the Center for Texas History at Texas Studies at TCU. His new book is called The Slave's Gamble, Choosing Sides in the War of 1812. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Gene, you mentioned earlier, almost in passing, that white Americans were sort of surprised at the fact that they could not count on the human beings they were keeping enslaved to fight on their side. I mean, can you speak to the context by which anybody would have thought that was even a possibility?
Well, I think, you know, Southern plantation owners were convinced that they were paternalistic, that they were good to their slaves, and that their slaves valued the lives that they lived with them. Now, in the book, I tell the story of Charles Ball, and Charles Ball is a man who had escaped from slavery and made his way back to his home in outside of Baltimore, actually on the Eastern Shore, I should say, and he is asked by the local white planters to go with them to the British fleet so that they can talk to the slaves who have already found their way to the British, and they were going to try to convince them to go back to bondage. Now, of course, the masters and slaves, they try to convince their slaves, and none of them accept, as it's kind of ironic that they even thought that they would accept. Mm-hmm. And they tell Charles Ball to stay the night there and to mingle among the slaves so that he can convince them to come back. Well, Ball does. He spends the night with them, and he tries to talk them into coming back. And, of course, none of them come back. And there was a British officer who asked Charles Ball if he wanted to come with them to freedom in a British colony. And Charles Ball said, well, certainly not. I'm a free man. I have land to cultivate. Well, the irony of it is that he was not a free man, and it would come back to haunt him later when he is dragged off into slavery again. But I think that episode there just kind of resonated with me why any master would think that their slaves would come back. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. But there, you know, I did find some quotes when white Southern plantation owners were convinced that their slaves were happy and that they would come back, that they lived good lives. And I think there's two sides to this picture. There's the side that the masters believed, and then there's the side that was the reality, and that was that slaves wanted freedom.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this idea of a gamble. As the war begins, first of all, before the war, it would have made sense that any able-bodied man would have been wanted by either side to fight on their side. But there
Certainly.
Were proscriptions in the United States against black soldiers serving at all.
Exactly. Under the U.S. Constitution, the Army and the Navy had both forbid blacks to serve as combatants. Now, they were permitted to serve as cooks and waiters and musicians. But once the war begins, now, first and foremost, we have to remember that Great Britain was fighting against France, and they are desperately in need of troops. So they're willing to use any fighting man that would offer their services. So by the spring of 1814, the British admiral in charge of the naval squadron in the Chesapeake Bay, he issues a proclamation promising freedom to all who will leave their masters. He will evacuate them if that's what they want. And if they want to enlist, he's willing to accept them as soldiers or sailors. Now, the Americans, they come to the realization a little bit later because they are placed in a precarious position. When British operations begin raiding the coast of the Chesapeake Bay, think about the planters that are living there. You know, the United States didn't have much of a military establishment, and they couldn't station troops all throughout the region, so it was left up to local militia. So whenever you see an enemy sail on the shore, the militia would come out, they would grab their muskets, and they would be looking for the British to land.
And it was that in Fort, like somebody blows a whistle, basically, and brings everybody out.
Yeah, or rings a bell, and everyone comes out, and they're looking for a British sail, and then they have to start looking over their shoulder. Because if the British are in the neighborhood, then slaves more aptly are going to try to get away.
Right.
And I think that was one of the shocking things that I came to realize. The British, I mean, there's roughly 1.1 million slaves in America at this time, and only about 5,000 of them are able to get to their freedom. And people have asked me, well, why weren't there more? Well, wherever the British landed, they were pulling, you know, they were liberating hundreds of slaves. But they're not, it's not a long war. It's only 2.5 years. And there's only about a maybe 2 years where there's really concentrated fighting in the Chesapeake or in the slaveholding areas. And when it, when because of the duration of the war, the slaves don't have as much of opportunity. And then if there's not a British army in the neighborhood, a slave's not going to take the chance for fear of severe punishment or potentially even death.
Right. So if you get caught, not only have you escaped from your master, but you have committed treason.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
How did the British train the black soldiers that it brought aboard? And we should say there, a lot of these guys also took their wives and their kids along with
them. Wives and their kids, exactly. In the summer of 1813, the British admiral named George Cockburn, the man who infamously burns Washington, D.C. He found an island in the middle of the Chesapeake called Tangier Island, and they began clearing the island. They built barracks, and they created a more or less a base there. They called it Fort Albion, and that became the depot for slaves who wanted to flee America. So every time a British operation went on to the shore, they would return, and there would be dozens of slaves with them. They would wait there on Fort Albion, on the island there at Tangier, until British supply ships arrived. The supply ships would offload their goods and the troops that they brought with them. They would load the slaves on them, and then they would take them to Bermuda. That would be the next depot point. Now, by basing there on Tangier Island, it was a presence that some slaves thought they could get to. Now, I had the wonderful opportunity spring a year ago to sail right through the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. And I'd never realized that when you're in the middle of the bay, there's times you cannot see each shore. And many people didn't swim. So unless you had access to a boat and you knew where you were going, it was a gamble for you to get there.
And, of course, once you got there, you had to survive the war in order to benefit from any of the promises that were made.
The British promised that any slave who arrived, they would evacuate them to a colony, or if they wanted to, they could enlist. And it was roughly about 600 men who enlisted in the British Colonial Marines. Now, these 600 men, they fought in a number of operations. They were a part of the British attack on Washington, and reportedly during that attack, they behaved far better than most of the other British soldiers did. They were involved in the attack on Baltimore, and then they would later participate in the New Orleans campaign. Now, getting there and becoming trained is one thing. The fear of death and the fear of fighting in combat, that's another thing. Now, the British officers who were in charge of these men commented almost universally that these men were brave and they were determined and they did anything and everything that you could hope for in a soldier.
So why did such a small percentage of the people who left want to fight? And I guess on the other side of it, why did anybody want to fight at all when they could just escape and be offered freedom elsewhere off U.S. shores?
Well, I think those who chose to fight, many of them young men who saw it as an occupation for the future. The British had had a long record of having West Indian regiments. These were black regiments raised in the Caribbean, and they had lifelong careers in the military. Well, there was a hope and expectation by many of these young men that once they became a colonial marine, that they could in fact have that for the rest of their adult lives.
But they could not aspire to leadership position still.
No, not in the British military. Now, one of the things I point out in this book, when we think of the War of 1812, it's a conflict between Great Britain and the United States. But for Americans, there was also another conflict between the United States and Spain.
Right.
And the Spanish do have black soldiers in Spanish Florida, and there are several of them that do become officers.
So talk about the promises that were made by the Americans, because at some point we realized we had to offer something and maybe
Certainly.
Benefit from,
yeah.
from the power of these young men who might be willing to fight.
Well, and I think we can look at the New Orleans campaign as a classic example of that. When Andy Jackson arrives in New Orleans in early December 1814, he is in desperate need of men. So he pulls together this ragtag assemblage. It's Louisiana Creoles of Spanish or French descent. And he's got Kentucky and Tennessee volunteers, and he's got a handful of regular troops. And he convinced John Lafitte and his Baratarian pirates to come. And then he has two regiments of free men of color. And then he also recruits slaves. And I always like to point out he had 25 Choctaw Indians. They tend to get overlooked in this this engagement. Now, what Jackson promised is that the free men of color would be paid the same amount as white soldiers, and they would be given the same land bounties that white soldiers receive. And that the slaves, Jackson reportedly promised them freedom once the victory had been gained. Well, once the battle is over, Jackson does not provide them with their freedom. And that created an angst and an antagonism toward him. And what he did, basically, once the battle is over, he had these men mustered. They laid down their weapons. And then he told them, you're going back into slavery. And because they were no longer armed, there was no way that they could stand up to this. The free men of color who were promised the same pay and land, they did receive the same pay. But the land promises that were made to them were not fulfilled until the late 1840s and the early 1850s. And by that point in time, many of them had already died, and their children and their descendants did not get the land. So the promises, I claim, were fleeting mm-hmm. and were never quite fulfilled.
Were you able to document whether it sounds like Andrew Jackson never intended to keep those promises?
I don't think he did. And when I began this project, you know, being an American and teaching the War of 1812, I always viewed the British as the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the British was the guy wearing the black hat, and the Americans wore the white hat. And what I learned in writing this book is that the Americans were the ones that really wore the black hat, and that the heroes were really the British and the Spanish. I mean, they liberated slaves, they evacuated slaves, and the slaves that they did take away from America, you know, they and their descendants spent in freedom, and that's what all these slaves wanted from the beginning.
Were those liberations, though, based on sort of pragmatism? Because there was still legal slavery within the British Empire in the colonies
Exactly, yeah. The British had outlawed the slave trade at the same time the United States did. And one of the stories I tell is that there were roughly 2,000 slaves taken to Canada. And the British governor there, he's determined that he's got to reduce the numbers because he has to feed them. And he gets about 1,000 of them convinced that they should go because, you know, it's cold in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
1,000 of them are willing to go to Trinidad. Now, Trinidad already had slavery. So these people were willing to take the chance of being re-enslaved to get out of the cold confines of Canada. The 1,000 or so that are sent to Trinidad, they're placed in the interior of the island, and they're able to carve a life out of the jungle. And it was a year-by-year struggle because every time they would clear land and cultivate it, well, the jungle would try to reclaim it. Well, the problem was these 1,000 or so, they couldn't read or write. So they're not able to send back messages to their family and friends in Canada saying, yeah, come to Trinidad. It's warm here. And so you have two separate communities that emerge, the Canadian community and the Trinidadian community.
And as people left the United States at the, I guess, the grace of the British Empire, what kind of life were they able to have, if the ones that actually went over to the British mainland?
Well, you can say that these people, that they do not live a prosperous economic life. Mm-hmm. They struggle year in and year out. In Canada and in Trinidad, they actually gain legal title to land by the 1840s, about the same time that the United States finally makes its promises of land to the free men of color.
That's a long time to wait.
It's a long time. It's a generation. Mm-hmm. And those who went to Canada and to Trinidad, they don't prosper economically, but they do have their freedom. And that's what they wanted. I mean, to me, as I was working on this story, it began as one thing. And by the time I finished it, I realized that this was a freedom story.
And of course, you face the challenge that many historians have in the past, that when you have some people who are treated like human beings and some people who are treated like property, it's hard to find names and exact details. Can you talk about that?
Well, this is a project that was ongoing for about 15 years. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, Chris. When you're working on slaves, slaves don't leave documentary records. You have to piece their existence together from a lot of fragmentary sources. And that's part of the reason that this project took as long as it did, because I was convinced that this is a project about people. I'm convinced that anytime you tell history, it's a story of people. And if we lose sight of the people, then we really lose sight of the fabric of the past. So I began the process of trying to unravel the stories of these individuals. Now, I'm able to tell some of those stories of individuals, but others, it's only collective at groups.
My guest is Gene Allen Smith. He's professor of history at TCU and curator of history at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. His new book is called The Slave's Gamble, Choosing Sides in the War of 1812. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gene Allen Smith. He is professor of history at TCU, where he also directs the Center for Texas Studies, and he's curator of history at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. He'll be speaking there on Tuesday at 7. His new book is called The Slave's Gamble, Choosing Sides in the War of 1812. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We have an email here, Gene, from Kelly in Dallas, who says, I'm interested in any comments on how the New Orleans mobilization might have laid the groundwork for the New Orleans Grays that fought in the Texas War of Independence.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. There's a black man who was a part of Jackson's force named Jordan Noble. He was known as the Drummer Boy, and he would later be participate in four separate American wars. He participated in the Seminole War, the Mexican War, and then at the beginning of the American Civil War, he raised a regiment of black troops for the Confederacy. Once the Union Navy came in and took New Orleans pretty early in the war, he then raised a regiment of troops for the Union. And I think what you've had there in the case of New Orleans, you had a sizable free black population. And performing in the militia and in the military was a way of demarking one's status in society. If you are a participant, then that means you have reached a certain level in society. and the men who ultimately are willing to take up arms, you know, these are guys who feel that they're fulfilling their civic obligation. So the question she has in regards to the men who end up going into Texas, you know, I don't know about them particularly, but I would venture to say that they are a part of that heritage of free men of color that had stretched all the way back to the colonial period under the Spanish and the French, so that by the time we get to the mid-19th century, military performance under the United States is one of the few avenues of advancement for free men of color.
Just to be clear, being free and of color didn't necessarily mean you were even allowed to live in a lot of parts of the early United States.
Certainly.
And you were not welcome in a lot of others, even if you were allowed to maintain
a residence. That's exactly right. And the urban centers are generally more willing to accept free people of color because there were so many opportunities for employment as domestics or as carpenters or blacksmiths or whatever one's profession might be. You know, one of the things I did when I was working on this project, there were these two regiments of free men of color that served with Jackson. So it's roughly about 650 men. And I tried to figure out who these guys were. And I spent more than a year going through census records and through notarial archives and looking through city guides. And the thing I found was that they were average people. I mean, they were bakers and they were grocers and they were tailors. And, you know, they all lived in kind of concentrated areas around one another. And when Jackson called them out to fight against the British, well, they picked up arms and fulfilled their civic obligation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thank you so much for this topic. It's very interesting. I studied African American history at your rival school, SMU.
Oh, we won't hold that against you.
So I know a little bit about this. Not too much. However, one thing that I know is listening to a historian talk about a couple of months ago was just the fact about how much Andrew Jackson hated blacks. The historian was talking about, and I also had read this before, when Frederick Douglass had first met Andrew Jackson, the way that initial look that Andrew Jackson gave him, Frederick Douglass immediately wrote after the meeting that this man is no friend of blacks.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right there. I think that's a wonderful statement and question. You know, Andy Jackson, we have to remember he is a Southerner, and he had grown up on the North Carolina frontier, and he had made a life for himself as a plantation owner, farmer in the Nashville area of Tennessee. But not only did he not like blacks per se, but he was not a great fan of Native Americans either.
Indeed. That may be the understatement of the year. Let's go to the phones once again. This time we have Donna on the line in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The guest said that he changed his mind from thinking the Americans were the good guys to thinking the Americans were the bad guys, and I was wondering what made him change his mind about that.
Well, you know, when I began this project, you know, I was born and raised in North Alabama, and I'm certainly an American. I feel like you know, the United States is one of the great places to live, and it's an opportunity to pursue knowledge and freedom. And when I began this project, I was convinced, and this project really grew out of a question a student asked me one time. We were talking about the Battle of New Orleans, and that question said, well, why do some blacks fight for Jackson, and why do some fight for the British? And you know, I said, well, let me check into this. I'll figure it out. Well, needless to say, 15 years later, and I sent this former student an email saying, well, you can buy the book and now you'll find what the answer really is. Well, I think what happens here is the United States becomes more of a slavery plantation nation in the aftermath of the War of 1812. What we understand as the Old South or the Deep South is an outgrowth of the post-War of 1812 era when those plantation lands open up across the Gulf South. And on the one hand, in the post-war period, the United States and slavery entrenches in the United States. On the other hand,
the British are and the Spanish both were taking slaves out of North America and liberating them. They're not giving them great economic opportunities, but they were giving them freedom, and that's what these individuals were looking for. So I say that tongue in cheek, you know, that the British and the Spanish were the good guys and the Americans were the bad guys, but that's the way the story unraveled.
Can you talk about Ned Simmons? We were discussing him in the break, and it's just, I mean, the story is, it's almost stranger than fiction the way the whole thing plays out.
It really is. Ned Simmons was a slave owned by Nathaniel Greene and his family. And Nathaniel Greene, one of the great Revolutionary War heroes. And when Greene dies, Ned Simmons ping-pongs around the family. He's given from one family member to another. And he remains a slave. And when the British invade Cumberland Island, Georgia, where he lived, January 1815, Ned Simmons is one of the first to volunteer to be a British soldier.
And he's already at this point like a middle-aged guy.
He is at this point in his – he's born in 1762, 63 or so. So you figure he's close to his 50s at this point, or maybe a little older than 50. And he willingly takes up a weapon. The British outfit him in a uniform, and the commanders keep him there on Cumberland Island to serve it as an example to other slaves who make it to Cumberland Island. They, too, can get a red uniform and be a soldier just like Ned Simmons. Well,
so things are looking up temporarily.
It seems like for Ned, he's got what he wanted. Well, the peace treaty between the United States and Great Britain is signed on Christmas Eve, 1814. It's ratified by the two governments in mid-February 1815, and by the early part of March, there are peace commissioners arriving on Cumberland Island saying, the war is over. You Brits, you have to give up all the spoils of war that you have captured. Well, the British admiral there, again, George Cockburn, the man who had burned Washington, he drags his heels a little bit, and he says, okay, I'm willing to give up what we have captured. Any property that was on the island as of the day of the ratification of the peace agreement, we will return that. All other slaves that have been evacuated, they are now free, and we cannot make them return. Well, poor old Ned Simmons had been staying there on the island. And according to the oral traditions, they said that the British soldiers came up and ripped his uniform off and took his weapon away from him. And as he was hanging onto his clothes, he grabbed a hold of a button on his uniform, and that became a prize item of his collection. Mm. Well, he remains a slave until the American Civil War. And in 1863, he and his daughter, they cross over Union lines into Union-controlled Florida.
He's 100 years old.
He's a centenarian at this point, exactly. And apparently his health is not great, but he and his daughter do make it there. And the Union soldiers, they declare him to be a free man. And he does a series of newspaper interviews with a local reporter. And there's a group of missionaries there that teach him to read. And it seemed like his world had finally come to fruition. But only a couple months after he had gained his freedom, Ned Simmons died. Hmm. And the last interview he gave before his death, he claimed that if anything were to happen to him, he could go to his Lord knowing that he was a free man. Now, when I was putting this part of the story together, I was literally on the verge of tears because it's a heart-wrenching story. And a part of the story that did not get into the book is this question about the button. Mm-hmm. In the 1990s, there were a series of archaeologists that were excavating the slave cabins of Dungeness Plantation. And lo and behold, they find a button from a British 1808 uniform. And that confirmed the oral traditions that Ned Simmons' family had passed along, which meant that that had been his prized possession. And, you know, poor old Ned, he did eventually get his freedom, but he had to live to be 100 years old to finally achieve that.
So as we discussed early in the hour, the acquisition of what had been Indian territories by the young United States by essentially exterminating or moving Native peoples out of those lands, put a lot more land in the Deep South for plantation farming, sure. Expanded the need, air quotes there, for slavery to provide labor. Why did attitudes towards slaves change, and why did slave owners become so much, I guess, harsher in their judgment of the people they kept enslaved?
Well, I think in the post-war period, to give you some ideas, during the decade immediately following the War of 1812, cotton production in the South increased about 100%. And over the period 1820 to 1850, it increases about 300%. So there is so much more cotton being grown. And cotton equated to wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant that if you had a successful cotton crop, you could acquire more land, you could acquire more slaves. You needed more slaves to cultivate that cotton. And I'm convinced that the economics of slavery that was equated to plantation agriculture, it alters the way that Southerners felt about their property. By the time of the American Civil War, there is this kind of universal belief that slaves were not people, but they were, in effect, property.
Mm-hmm. Do you really think, had the War of 1812 not played out the way it did, could we have dispensed with slavery without the bloodshed taken by the Civil War?
I hint that in my book. There is a kind of a revolutionary fervor from the post-war period, post-revolutionary war period, in which Americans are willing to consider. And if you look across the North, most of the northern states were abolishing slavery. And in southern states, many of the states were starting to lessen their hold on slavery. I'm convinced that the War of 1812 forced them to harden their attitudes again, because on the one hand, they had given a little bit of freedom to slaves, and look how they had paid them back. You know, on the one hand, slaves were running away to British freedom. On the other hand, sometimes they were leading redcoat troops right back into their former neighborhoods. And I think at that point, many plantation owners were just convinced that slaves couldn't be trusted.
Gene Allen Smith is professor of history at TCU and curator of history at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. You can find him online at genesmithbooks.com. The new book, of course, is called The Slave's Gamble, Choosing Sides in the War of 1812. Gene, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.